I'll reconvene the hearing. Carry on.
Paragraph 9. In relation to 1 Hampton Road, notified Rule 15 prior court outlines some additional standards for the centre. As notified, in a potential local shopping centre zone of 7,000 square metres of commercial activity at this location to enable, which in my view goes well beyond the local convenience centre. This is compounded by the ability to establish some large format retail tenancy, i.e. 500 plus square metres, and the provision of 3,000 square metres GFA of office space with no tenancy cap to prevent large office tenancies establishing on the site. The notified provisions for 1 Hampton Road need to be revised to ensure large format retail activity and the ability for large scale office tenancies to establish is removed in order for the site to more appropriately meet the objectives of the PDP. I also recommend that the zone of 1 Hampton Road should be reduced in size to a land area similar to other centres in the zone, and the balance of the land enabled for residential and visitor accommodation that does not have the ground floor commercial. I consider that the opportunity cap of around 200 square metres per tenancy would ensure that any offices establishing within the zone are small scale and focused on the local residential area as contemplated by the purpose, objectives and policies of the zone. I note that I've read the evidence of Mr. Greaves as it relates to the local shopping centre zone. I have concerns that the zone at Cadrona Valley, like at 1 Hampton Road, is too large. Assuming all the areas developable and given its location close to the Wanty Town Centre. I understand there is a rezoning submission seeking that the local shopping centre zone is reduced in size and that matter is therefore best considered in the rezoning hearings. I've also read the evidence of Mr. John Falkenhorn, who supports larger tenancy caps on behalf of his client, the Gordon Family Trust. He considers 400 square metres GFA as the more appropriate maximum tenancy size in the local shopping centre zone, and considers this as more consistent with the PDP. I disagree. Scale is an important focus of the zone, as is the convenience nature of the retail and commercial service offer anticipated from the zone. The 400 square metre maximum GFA threshold is well above the average convenience store size and is likely to require a significant proportion of the store sales to be derived from customers who reside beyond the local area to remain viable. Mr. Falkenhorn also considers fashion should be able to go into the local shopping centre zone to satisfy tourist demand. That rationale is, in my view, flawed, as local residents are just as likely, if not more likely, to shop at a local fashion store as well. Using tourists as validation for his opinion masks the real potential effects once considered across the entire local shopping centre zone, and duplicates one of the core functions of the town centres in the business network, Waikato, Queenstown, Narrowtown, etc. The suggested inclusion of fashion also needs to be considered with Mr. Falkenhorn's 400 square metre maximum GFA threshold, which means large fashion stores would be able to establish in the local shopping centre zone. This would require such stores having to attract customers from extensive areas to remain viable, creating strong tension with the intent of the zone. Mr. Falkenhorn promotes mobile phone stores and homeware store types as appropriate for the local shopping centre zone. These store types do not sell convenience or frequently required goods or day-to-day requirements, and as such, I do not consider these store types as convenience retailers nor appropriate for the local shopping centre zone. They are store types that are important to the function and amenity of large town centres. In relation to the Cadrona Valley Road local shopping centre zone, Mr. Falkenhorn promotes a 1,500 square metre supermarket and another large store of up to 750 square metres GFA as appropriate. No detailed analysis is provided to justify this position. I disagree that these store sizes are appropriate given the scale and the close proximity of the Cadrona Valley zone site to the Wanaka and Tree Park Centre. We also have a convenience role in the market and serve at the same market as the Cadrona Valley local shopping centre zone. This proposition by Mr. Falkenhorn would represent duplication of resources within the same market and, in my view, undermine the Wanaka and Tree Park Centre function. Mr. Falkenhorn promotes a 400 square metre GFA office provision in the Wayside Shopping Centre zone. For context, the business of this size could accommodate up to 20 employees. He then goes further for the Corona Valley Road zone by stating no office cap at all is required. He provides no relevant evidence to support his view and no economic evidence on the implications of such a policy setting. In my view, office activity of this scale goes well beyond the intent and purpose of the zone and potentially could end up with an outcome that looks nothing like a local convenience centre. Overall, Mr. Falkenhorn appears to be promoting a range of activities in the local shopping centre zone that better represent a wider centre zone than a reworked local shopping centre zone, particularly at the Cadrona Valley Road site. He has also failed, in my view, to consider the appropriate policy context and has not considered the wide economic implications of the proposed policy settings when assessed against the entire local shopping centre zone across the district and the strategic approach to business as outlined in strategic directions, objectives and policy. In my view, it's very difficult for a retail economic expert to generate thresholds for any centre, whether it be a local shopping centre, without understanding or considering the policy context within which this centre sits. In my view, based on the evidence that Mr. Falkenhorn, I don't think he's undertaking that task to any material degree. The Wanaka Airport Zone. The proposed rezoning of Wanaka Airport from rural to a zoning similar to the notified Queenstown Airport mixed use zone has also been considered. There are important locational differences between the Wanaka and Queenstown Airports that require consideration. Wanaka Airport is located in a more isolated rural environment, some distance from an urban area. This results in the source of commercial demand at Wanaka Airport being more distant than that of Queenstown Airport. As such, demand for non-aviation commercial activity at Wanaka is likely to be very low and simply reflect the demand generated by localised airport business activity. In considering these differences, it is my view that the level of non-aviation related commercial activity enabled at Wanaka Airport should be kept to a minimum. In relation to the activities proposed to be contained within the definition of vehicle-related activity on Wanaka Airport, I consider a total non-aviation and non-ancillary related commercial provision of 1,000 square metres GFA sufficient to accommodate foreseeable demand within the Wanaka Airport zone, with an individual non-aviation non-ancillary tenancy cap of 100 square metres. Such a provision would have no consequential retail, economic or commercial effects on Wanaka's commercial centres, whilst at the same time providing some flexibility for Wanaka Airport to provide some small-scale retail, commercial service or office activity to support Wanaka Airport's operations and employment base. I've read the evidence of Rachel Trigitska and Mr. Kyle in relation to current size of commercial activity at the Wanaka Airport zone. Both do not want to see a 1,000 square metre GFA limit for non-aviation, non-ancillary commercial activity, basically standalone retail and office, as part of a policy framework. This is basically a trust-us approach and is akin to thinking the market left to its own devices would not establish anything untoward. I consider such an approach a high-risk strategy for council. In my experience, airports are like any other commercial operator, seeking year-on-year improved returns and performance from its property holdings. Mr. Giga makes this clear by stating QAC seek alternative means to make profit. Retail and commercial office activity is a prudent way of delivering increased commercial and shareholder returns. And that's been a trend being witnessed on the ground now in airports around the main commercial airports around the country, Auckland, Christchurch and Wellington, and like that. Queenstown Airport. I know I've read the evidence of Mr. Sargent and Mr. Kyle in respect of short-term visitor accommodation at Queenstown Airport in the future. I do not have an issue and see that activity as complementary to the airport's function.
Thank you very much. Can we just link with where you've just finished the Wanaka Airport zone? Have a discussion around that. Now, it's paragraph 19 in your summary. You make the point that there's, as you said anyway, little demand for non-aviation commercial activity at Wanaka. And then you told us about the main centre, New Zealand main centre airports, and you referred to the growth of non-aviation related commercial activity.
That's right.
Now, is there any circumstance that you're aware of nationwide where a smallish type airport like Wanaka has been able to attract these kind of non-commercial, non-aviation type commercial activities?
I've done a lot of work for Hamilton Airport, Palmerston North Airport, a little bit for Tauranga, as well as the larger Wellington, Auckland, Christchurch airports. I suppose the more historic model that the airports have run of generating the bulk of their income through landing fees and passenger fees, etc., is a thing in the past. They are now expanding, trying to expand the provision to have non-aviation related activities on their landholds, because of a fast landhold, you can get a return. And they're using those non-aviation activities to help fuel increases in income because of trying to offset the fall in passenger fees, etc. So, yes, a lot of them, Hamilton has got a new business park called Titanium Park, so done some work at Palmerston North Airport, who are trying to secure office parks, some additional scope into the land use activities that are aviation related, but also non-aviation related, and office parks specifically in some retail elements to service the surrounding residential market. So most airports in the country, provincial airports particularly, are actually starting to diversify from away from aviation activity into looking to see what other activity they can keep on their landholding and to maximise their return.
Now, I understand that trend, and yes, you know, observe it whenever I'm settled off to an airport, and I can see that. The point I'm trying to discuss with you, though, is do you see that Wanaka Airport is in any way different? You've made the point in your evidence that there doesn't seem, on your view of it, to be demand for non-aviation commercial activity, full stop. So, you know, I'm just questioning whether if you like, the threat is ever going to arise at Wanaka. And that's really what I want your view on.
Well, I mean, I suppose the threat is from the point of the airport's position, where they've been quite open about stating they're looking for other activities on their land holdings to drive income. So, I suppose the threat from the market, a market-driven response would be minimal, or at the lower end of the scale, but from the landowner's perspective, the threat could be a lot more real because the business is to drive income.
And would that sort of threat be manifested by the airport company offering incentives and the like to attract non-aviation activity to somehow locate on their expensive landholdings?
Absolutely. Yes, yes. In a market like Wanaka, there's so much demand. Yeah. So it's up for grabs, so to speak, on who gets that growth. And they would form part of that market at that point, and they may have a lot more financial clout behind them, often incentives to attract those businesses to their landholding via the another more appropriate zone.
If that circumstance played out and was eventually this with the airport company offering these incentives, and there was a level of response to it, do you see that the effects of that response would be restricted just to Wanaka, or would they go further afield? Is it possible they could affect Queenstown, for example?
I see Queenstown Airport and Wanaka Airport quite soon, distinctly, in terms of the role of function and the location attributes. In Wanaka's case, increased retail, standalone retail and office activity there would have the propensity to undermine the growth of the Wanaka Town Centre and Three Parks Town Centre, given that they've changed the market to go around. So that would change the commercial dynamics of Wanaka per se. In terms of Queenstown, I think there is enough capacity for those activities either side of the airport at 5 Mile and the Markham's Park, to suggest to me that there is no unmet requirement in the market for that specific facility that Queensland Airport itself. So that would be, in essence, just duplicating the resource rather than providing something new to the market.
Okay, that's it. Now, in terms of non-aviation and non-ancillary for Wanaka, you recommend or you reach the position of 1,000 square gross floor area,
yes.
And you've looked at individual non-aviation, non-ancillary tenancy cap of 100 square metres.
That's correct.
Right. In your summary a little earlier, though, in your principal evidence, when we're looking at definition of airport-related Wanaka Airport at 414 and 415, you're talking about your support for the words and ancillary to the use of the airport.
Right.
So we're talking about two different categories of activity occurring here.
That's right. With the cap, the 1,000 square metre cap, what I did want to get caught up in that is, for example, a genuine airport-related activity or an activity that requires debugging at the airport, such as a helicopter. And I didn't want to get caught with the office component of that activity, which is the primary activity for that particular business, getting caught up in the 1,000 metre cap. Because every activity that goes to the airport may have an element of office of various scales. Office admin functions, to take calls to tourists, to go on a helicopter flight, etc. Those are appropriate to have associated with ancillary to that particular activity. But it's not a standalone activity. The reason that office is there is because the main activity is there. But it's not like a standalone architecture firm that has no bearing or relationship with people at all. It's just an opportunistic tenancy. Because it can go there, not because it should go there, or should go more for its own location, but it's more centre. So there's a difference there in my thinking in relation to the 1,000 square metre.
Right, right. But you're still recommending 1,000 square metres for non-aviation and non-ancillary at Wanaka, with a cap on each individual tenancy of being 100 square metres.
That's correct.
As well as that, we've got your views about other uses, but they are to be ancillary to the use of the airport. That's referring you to your main evidence where you're discussing airport-related activity, Wanaka Airport. I just want to make sure that I'm getting my positions right.
Are you talking about
414 and 415.
So what I'm saying is I'm generally comfortable with the definition of the airport related activities. However, where I may depart from the council's view at this point in time is the use of the ancillary activity element of it. Whereas under the current definition, my understanding is, and Ms. Holt will be able to clarify, the office component of the helicopter, for example, I use, would get caught up in a 1,000 square metre cap. Well, I'm saying, no, that shouldn't get caught up in a 1,000 square metre cap. That is part of that airport related activity, so that falls outside of it.
All right. Now, I just want to discuss with you the local shopping centres.
Sure.
And first point is around the caps that you've come up with of 300 square metres.
Yes.
Now, that's a gross floor area approach.
Correct.
So it's just the actual, the total gross floor area that's available in the premise and the unit. It's not divided in any way in terms of a part which is utilised for retail activity and a part that's used for staff or anything like that. It's just a total gross floor area.
Of the facility within that zone.
Yeah.
And the back of house component of individual tenancy typically is around 25 to 30% of the total floor area of the tenancy.
Mm.
So there's an element of storage,
So that's counted within the 300. I'm just trying to be clear that there's no sort of carve out from, well, there is actually a carve out from the 300, but you're not excluding them.
No.
See, back of office type functions or back of store type functions.
As part of the 300 or anything like that, then the actual, I suppose, the retail trading footprint that the public had access to is quite small.
Yeah, quite small. Okay. Now, when you go through and give us some gross floor areas for the types of activities, types of stores, retail stores we expect in the local service centre zone, they're quite a bit smaller than the 300 square metres.
Correct.
And you justify the exceedance by saying, well, that allows for some variety.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't there a risk that being towards that sort of larger size, 300 square metres, they open above a 120 square metre type, corner theory type circumstance, that that's going to create some pressure in terms of, other types of activities wanting to locate within the local shopping centre that perhaps aren't really appropriate?
Well, hence my position to identify some of those other store types which are not considered appropriate and exclude them from the zone.
Yeah. I see that, but one of the challenges about sort of identifying what can't go there, what are you going to do, give the list of those that shouldn't be there or whatever. The point I'm making is that the square meterage is, it's a pretty rough and ready tool, but it's a useful tool in terms of restricting types of activities.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make it attractive, for somebody who wants a bit more floor space to go there.
What we tend to find in some of those local centres is the tenancy type that gets close to the 300 metres and sometimes goes above it is pubs, other than taverns, because they often have an outdoor area that's sometimes covered and sometimes not covered. So it provides that flexibility. Now, in my experience, not every retail tenancy in the local centre zone is going to get close to the 300 metre mark, but it does provide that flexibility for some store types that may need to be able to move a bit more elbow room in relation to the product type it's offering, to go to a slightly larger level that will not impact on the higher order centres in the network. So it's a pragmatic approach to provide a level of flexibility for the development community, but also to ensure the outcome for council that they're not going to end up with something more than the local convenience.
Okay. Now, I may not have this right, but are there limits in terms of office-type activities that can locate in these zones?
Under my proposal, there is.
Under your proposal?
There's a GFA cap of 200.
200 for offices?
Yes, and that's based on in the order of, all new office GFA is really a lot more efficient than some of the older office stock. It's more rebel-oriented, it's now more open plan, and you can fit more employees in a modern, efficiently developed office. So the 200 square metre allows anywhere between up to 8 employees. So it's still getting towards a generous mark, but it's for smaller scale businesses. Going beyond that, and you're starting to enable some more medium-sized and large-scale businesses to locate the local shopping center zone, which I'm saying now, fit with the zone purpose and achievements.
Okay. Coming to paragraph 3.8 of your principal evidence, as we discussed, notified of 15.2.1. This is the point you just made about, not competing with. What one of you the use of the word supplement in that objective, is that sort of, do you have any comments about the appropriateness of that choice of word?
Yes, because what it says is it works with those higher order centres, and it's not a separate category in its own right. Those town centres also have an important convenience function playing the market as well, and have convenience stores that are important to this. It's wrong function. So it's not saying that it's performing a role separate to those higher order town centres, but there's an overlap there. So what we're doing is supplementing it, we're providing some localised convenience so the community doesn't have to travel those great businesses to town centres. And I think that's one of the and that one purpose of his own. So, as understanding that, really, that the town centre, and it's an important point, because the town centre plays an important convenience role in the market as well. So we don't want to do something that competes or conflicts with that in terms of scale. So we've got to keep it small scale, low key, very localised, self-trusting us rather than attracting on make the draw back the draw and have an impact on those higher order centres.
Just turning to paragraph 9 in the summary, we start talking about one person in the role. I'm just wondering there, in that paragraph in the next, you discuss that particular site and the size of it. When you came to the opinions that you came to in terms of the size of development being appropriate, were you considering that site alone, or were you considering that in the context of the rest of the local shopping centre zone in that immediate, that it adjoins? Well, it doesn't quite adjoin, because there's a cemetery in the way, but we'll say it adjoins.
Yeah. No, I was looking at that site specifically, but I was aware of the other surrounding retail division.
Are you familiar with the activity in the remainder of that shopping centre zone?
5 Mile, Marcus Park, I am,
no,
and Limited with the one across the road.
Right.
Yeah.
If you took that, well, if you were considering a local shopping centre, would you consider One Hanson Road to be a separate local shopping centre from the local shopping centre which comprises the area immediately to the west of it, the other side of the cemetery?
No, I wouldn't. I would probably say it would form part of a wider retail destination. One on one side of the road, one on the other side of the road. It'll have different levels of opportunity to attract traffic, depending on where the traffic is going. But in terms of servicing the local within space, I wouldn't see it as a separate destination or a separate venture itself.
There's a roundabout at the end of that structure. Prevention is not necessarily an issue, is it?
Yes, albeit the, I'm not a traffic expert, but there would be some access issues to be dealt with, I suggest.
Okay. So in paragraph 13, when you're talking about the inclusion of fashion, so Mr. Porkinghorn's suggestion, if we were to agree with that proposal, could we expect to see something like Dressmart occurring on that basis?
Theoretically, yes.
Well, I mean in theory, I wasn't meaning given the market and what.
Yeah, in terms of strict DFAs, you could, depending if the individual tenancies were individualised and entitled. But the whole dress mask or concept is slowly, I'd say, a bit of a sinking piece, and that's been largely offset by the introduction of the internet retailing. Which is making the dress marts around the country really start to reconsider their strategies and slowly fall away.
Yes. Just related to that and your answers to Commissioner Rogers' questions, and you were talking about excluding certain activities. in your view, should the district plan have a list of, say, ASIC classifications that cannot occur, or alternatively, a list of classifications that could occur in the zone?
In my experience, I don't have an issue with that, because I think it provides greater clarity for both council administering the plan and developers wanting to undertake rehab development in a specific zone, about what is the thinking behind the zone, what's included and not included. So where may be some tension created with the policy of the zone, and where may be a more seamless path. But and it's also, I'm a great believer that anyone in the street should be able to pick up a plan and understand it and follow it. And I think having that provides greater clarity and understanding for people in the community who want to understand the plan. So I don't have an issue with that.
Are you familiar with the early reports that underpinned the business strategy in the district? There was the McDermott-Miller report and then the McDermott peer review report. Are you familiar with both of those reports?
I've read a confined element relating to the retail of those one reports.
The reports diverge from recommendations, correct?
On the page.
Which report do you would you feel most comfortable in supporting as an expert?
To be honest, I have concerns with both. Not so much what's in them, what's not in them. And I think there's a lot more robust analysis and data available to provide better guidance for council policy making and to give better guide, provide direction to the policy that should be imposed or developed for the district plan. So I have the information they provided, how a good story on the stuff that is analysed and then is in the reports. But in my view, there's more compelling analysis and data available that will provide better information and better guidance for the council. So it's part of the story, not the complete picture, which I would expect to be done and have been done by the experts, given the context in which they're providing that advice to council, and it would be an expectation for other district plans around the country as well, if they're going through this crisis.
So,
all the other than that, the brief was
So, given that answer, are you able to tell us whether, in your view, the better information available should be directing the council to more control of the range of activities in each of the business zones or less?
I can't answer that at this point in time. my focus on you is obviously really
right. Now, totally different direction.
Yes.
Just the Hawkinshorn provided a whole lot of economic analysis on the retailing, both by locals and tourists. Do you have the expertise to have a comment on that? The question then in his analysis of how the retail expenditure, he took the number of households and made a factor increase in expenditure because to account for the higher wealth of the area. Would you consider that an appropriate approach, or would you consider consideration of the household expenditure patterns to be more useful?
I think the approach that he's adopted, again, can be supplemented by more accurate data. Why are we trying to estimate the level of retail spend in a particular area when it can be actually determined with a little bit of an unusual approach? We can provide estimates based on household spend, business spend, and tourist spend. But we can provide an accurate breakdown of that by using actual retail transaction data. So the point of estimating forecasts and projections using factors and assumptions is an approach that can be taken, but I think a more robust approach can be taken by actually looking at what's being spent in the area, what proportion of the spend in Queenstown District comes from local residents, what proportion comes from visitors, when that occurs, what sectors that spend is on. Obviously, visitors have a higher propensity to buy food and beverage, going to restaurants and so forth, rather than buying furniture for their house. So we can have a more fine-grained analysis and picture of actually the demand for the Queenstown area and for the Wanaka area. And at this point in time, from what I've seen of the data and information available, we don't have that yet. So his approach is one approach, but I think a better approach would be to try and minimise the level of assumptions and factors into the modelling where appropriate. I mean, the more theoretical aspects were what we used probably 10 years ago, but we had a lot more available data or data available to us these days, which can just make things a little bit more accurate, which is what I think we should use.
I was just wondering why then do you think Mr. Bob would want use the sort of theoretical approach as distinct from the database approach. Can you think of any reasons why you would have done that?
No, unless it's a scope issue or a budget issue, I'm not too sure. But it's quite common practice to utilise the marketing data. And I think the court accepts that these days because it's available to all parties to make a more informed decision, more accurate decision. So I'm not too sure why you have to get that and help him on this out.
Thank you.
Yes.
I think Central Park, Queenstown has been identified as having a particular historical character, which is based on its establishment of the Central Gold Mining Rush of the 1850s. I was one of the original authors of the Queenstown Town Centre Character Guidelines, commissioned by the QLPC in 2007 and updated in 2015. My evidence generally relates to the proposed height restrictions in the special character area of the town centre as they affect the guidelines. The proposed height restrictions are generally similar to the operative district plan, but there are a small number of minor, non-substantive changes which provide clarity and, in my view, provide closer links to the guidelines. I support the recommended Queenstown Town Centre Chapter 12 attached to the Section 42A report by Vicky Jones dated 2nd November 2016, as far as the provisions and recommended changes are addressed in my evidence, including removal of the setbacks from the Beach Street area. However, in response to the evidence Mr. Timothy Williams stated the 18th of November 2016, I have amended my views on one point which I described below. I support part of Mr. Williams' evidence, paragraph 38 to 42, which seeks to make breaches of the height plane the extended height precinct 5, a restricted discretionary activity rather than a non-compliant activity. However, in my view, this would only relate to the treatment of corners on corner sites, and its matters for discretion include close adherence to other matters in the guidelines. The guidelines relate to architectural design within the special character area and do not attempt to deal with urban design matters. It may be appropriate for council to commission a separate urban design guide to the area in the future. However, urban design is beyond my skill set and I am unable to comment further on the content of any such guide.
Yes, good afternoon. You're starting with paragraph 5 of your summary. Could you just expand on that a little for me, particularly your comment about the restriction only to relate to treatment of corners on the site, corners on corner sites?
Going wider first. I think if the height restrictions were generally a restricted discretionary activity rather than non-complying, there would be very little point in the rest of the provisions. However, in the guidelines, I actually identified a specific type of corner treatment which would exceed the recession planes and guidance and height restrictions of the main body of the building. One example, for instance, but not in the special character area, is the building known as the Forge, which is on the corner of Camp Street and Shottesworth Street, and is illustrated in, I think it's 4A of the guidelines. I'll just check that reference for you. Yes, 4A built example on page 48 of the guidelines, and the other example is the clock tower building on the corner of Shottesworth Street and Camp Street. Both of those are suitable proposals which, well not proposals, suitable designs which still allow the rest of the character guidelines to be worked through and adopted successfully.
Now, turning to the guidelines themselves, can you just help me better understand, I've read the guideline attached to your brief, the July 2015 one, and there's comments sprinkled throughout it where development in the special character area is required to be consistent with the guidelines and council consider consistency with the guidelines and matters of that sort. So how does it actually work in practice if a development isn't consistent with the guideline? What actually happens?
Well, I can give you one example of a building which no matches the guideline whatsoever, but that's probably not politic. They still seem, up until now, it was voluntary.
Up until now, it was voluntary.
It's proposed to be incorporated in the district plan as a matter for consideration. So I don't have a clear idea of the process, but I imagine that it would form, that the principles of the guidelines would form, if it was restricted discretion, for instance, matters for assessment. And council officers would have to see how the design formed against the various elements. I designed the guidelines to be in two parts, but there are, although there are a large number of characteristics of the historic buildings in Queenstown, some of them I felt were primary and some were secondary. So for instance, the page I was just referring you to, or the section relating to form sites, is a primary one, whereas there are other matters. That's a secondary matter, whereas for instance large sites or front staff are more critical. So if the council staff were presented with an application, they would go, hopefully they would work through the document and in the sections which are headed 3, they would want to be sure that the majority of those aspects have been adopted. But there would be more flexibility with the secondary elements, which are 4. And even then, I don't believe that it's essential for every element of the primary elements to be included. I think if overall the design has incorporated most of them, you will get a building that, in my opinion, would fit with the historical character of Queenstown that the council is trying to maintain.
And is it your understanding that that would be a council officer who would assess an application against these guidelines now that they're included as a matter of discretion?
I'm not a planner, but that's my understanding.
Ask the specialist witnesses, Ms. Shah Swinney, the council officer might be briefly explain today, really understanding of this.
Yes,
I'm the team leader for alcohol licensing in Queenstown Extra Council. We have approximately 430 licenses in the district that we help administer. There's myself and two colleagues for the entire district. And we deal primarily with the alcohol licensing related matters on behalf of the district licensing commission. There are some areas of overlap between the Sound Supply of Alcohol Act 2012 and the Reckless Management Act 1991. However, the two regimes have different purposes and so not all areas are necessarily covered under the SACA, which are covered under the RMA and vice versa. In my view, controlled activity status for the activity of operating licensed premises would be appropriate in the town centre zone and the town centre transitional cell zone. I am supportive of allowing the use of outside spaces until 11 p.m. and dining outside until 12 a.m. without the need to obtain resident consent. Noise related issues can be dealt with under the emergency order provisions of the SACA. Previous resource consents that prevent this use as a matter of course were granted prior to the commencement of the SACA. In relation to the submission requesting a restriction on the number of licensed premises, there is currently no evidence in the Queenstown Lakes District to suggest restricting the number of licensed premises would decrease the noise level in the town centre or the density of premises as an issue. The same wharf complex would be subject to resource consent requirements if premises were requesting to operate outside until 11 p.m. and to 12 a.m. for the purposes of dining. This provision would be in place due to the location of the complex in relation to a major hotel. For existing premises, if the outside dining hours were extended to 12 a.m, extension of alcohol license hours could be addressed during the state of the licensing process. I support the permitted PDP time limit and notified rule 12.4.4, aligning with the default national maximum trading hours provision in section 43 of the SACA. I do not believe that there are any specific reasons and different plan that justify different trading hours. This last point is unfortunately the news out of my evidence. However, I consider that reference to liquor and the PDP should be amended to alcohol in accordance with the SACA.
So on the back page on my copy, I hope you read the final sentence of the reference. Yeah. Yes. So the location of the Steamer Wharf complex to the major hotel, that's the only distinguishing factor that is relevant there.
Correct.
Okay.
you, Stuart. Now, call Mr. Jones, who is the Section 42 report author, and the speaker of the Queenstown Town Centre Zone and also the Wanaka Town Centre Zone. So this, the summary of evidence from the speaker of each of those zones. Do you want to run them together or deal with them separately in terms of your question? If so, which one would you like to deal with first?
I think it would be easier if we dealt with them separately, because each of them is quite different issues. And probably we just take them in the order, chapter order, Queenstown first, then Wanaka. And we'll do the same when we get to Ms. Bovine's issue dealing with three, I think. It's the very same there.
All right then, so I will, Ms. Jones will be familiar to our members.
Yes, certainly.
Yes, so Ms. Jones is the top kind of place here. And she's been involved in the parenting in state.
I've been engaged by the QLDC to provide planning evidence on Chapter 12, Queenstown Town Centre, the proposed district plan. While I recommend that the policy direction and general intent to notify Chapter 12 provisions should remain largely unchanged, I also recommend that there be a large number of changes aimed at improving the effectiveness and or efficiency of the chapter. The provisions as recommended to be amended in my 42A report are considered to be effective and efficient and an appropriate means of achieving the purpose of the Act, the RMA, and the strategic direction objectives of the CDP. The recommended provisions include objectives that recognise the Queenstown Town Centre will continue to develop as a high quality and vibrant hub that makes a valuable contribution to economic viability and the overall resilience of the community, while striking a balance between providing for growth and diversity on the one hand and quality of design and a reasonable level of residential amenity on the other. Also includes policies and rules that enable increases in height and building coverage in many parts of the Queenstown Town Centre, provided that design quality is maintained or enhanced, provide for more efficient land use through some peripheral expansion and providing better for four-storey development in some areas, retain the compactness and walkability of the Queenstown Town Centre, encourage increased focus on pedestrian, cyclists and public transport users, encourage the development of a safe climate environment, and recognise the important contribution that nighttime activity makes to vibrancy and economic prosperity while providing reasonable residential amenity. The key substantive changes that I've recommended in the 42A report relate to changes to building heights in the Mann, Hay, Shotover and Wesson Street blocks, the increasing height precinct P7 and P1, replacing two areas notified as precinct P4 or precinct P5, thereby reinstating a more restrictive recession plan in those areas, and clarifying the permitted heights in precinct P1A and precinct P2. Amending rule 12.4.6 to exempt temporary top-up buildings and permanent and temporary artworks from requiring resource consent in relation to its design, adding an additional matter for consideration into rules 12.46 and 12.59 related to curbside movements and landmark buildings, amending rule 12.5.11 to exempt noise from commercial motorised craft and making consequential amendments to chapter 36, which is the noise chapter, amending figure 1 location of pedestrian links between the Queenstown Town Centre, and rule 12.5.8 to require existing links and lanes to be retained and to encourage future potential lanes to be uncovered. Removing rules that I consider inefficient and or ineffective, being those regarding glare from building materials and colour, the need for storage to be within a building, and the provision of verandas on Hay Street. Amending rule 12.5.1.1 to trigger the need to comply with the maximum coverage rule on all properties or developments over 1400 square metres in area, as opposed to the notified 1800 square metre threshold, and defining comprehensive development. Removing the street scene setback requirements on Beach Street, which is rule 12.5.2, and amending notified planning maps 35 and 36 to clearly show the waterfront, the Queenstown Town Centre waterfront subzone boundary, and minor amendments to rules 12.47 and 12.48 to refer to the waterfront subzone ahead of a sub-zone of the town centre rather than as a standalone zone. In relation to the memoranda that has been filed by the council on the 8th and 18th of November and the summary of evidence of Mr. Timothy Church dated 25th of November, I wish to confirm that I support the Appendix 1 version of the pedestrian link map and the Appendix 2 version of the height precinct map as attached to the memorandum filed 8th November. I support the Appendix 2 version of Rule 12.5.10.4 as attached to the memorandum filed 18th November in relation to height matters, and I support Appendix 1 versions of 2 and 20 as attached to the summary evidence of Mr. Church at the 25th of November. I also recommend amending Rule 12.4.6.1 in relation to the matter of discretion related to natural hazards, so that the word remedy is replaced with the word reduced in order to make it consistent with the wording of similar rules elsewhere in the community. Further to the above, I also recommend a number of additional changes in relation to matters I have considered since filing my 42A report, and specifically in response to evidence filed on behalf of submitters. I consider that these additional amendments will result in more appropriate provisions that will better contribute to the district-wide objectives in the purpose of the RMA. Therefore, in addition to Appendix 1 of my 42A report, I now recommend the following additional amendments. Amending policy 12.2.2.5 to acknowledge the creation of landmark buildings on key corner sites is another example of an urban design outcome that is beneficial to the public environment. This is in response to the evidence of Mr. Williams on behalf of various submitters. Shifting rules 12.5.10.1d, 12.5.10.2a or 12.5.10.2b to become new rules 12.5.9.3 and 12.5.9.4, thereby making the breach of the recession plan standard and height precincts 2, 4 and 5 restricted discretionary activities rather than non-compliant. This is in response to Mr. Williams and Mr. Farrell's evidence. Amending the Queenstown Town Centre zoning purpose to acknowledge the importance of the waterfront subzone and policies 12.253 and 12.256 to provide more direction in terms of development within the subzone, as shown in Appendix 1 to the summary hearing. Adding more detail on the planning map to more clearly distinguish between the active frontage and the Queenstown Beach and Gardens foreshore areas of that subzone, and making minor non-substantive amendments to Rules 12.47 and 12.48 to refer to the two areas within the Queenstown Council's waterfront subzone. This is in response to Ms. Carter's evidence. And amending Rule 12.471 to make moorings within the Queenstown Beach and Gardens foreshore area of the waterfront subzone and restricted discretionary activity rather than permitted as in the notified version. This is on the basis that this will be more effectively conserve the natural qualities and amenity values of the foreshore and adjoining waters. Policy 12.253 enables tentative effects of such to be considered by a resource consent and be more consistent with the rules relating to moorings in the majority of the Franklin Arms. This is in response to evidence of Ms. Black and Ms. Carter. In Appendix 1, I include the proposed amendment with relation to the waterfront subzone,
on those amendments that you set out in paragraph 6, you have some and appendix 1. Would it be possible for us to see the others?
Yes.
And it can be tomorrow, so I'm sure that you'll still be here tomorrow.
Yeah, that's no problem at all.
It's just I'd like to see what the rules are that you propose through there.
There's more changes.
And the changes to 12.225, which we have. Policy 12.225. I'd like to see those amendments as well, thanks.
If the panel doesn't mind, there's also a couple of minor points I'd like to make with regards to the 42A and the provisions. Just in reading through it all again, I noticed a map that had gone a little bit skewed, and also a few places where in the provisions the underlining hasn't come through. And so if I had got to be able to take you through and underline them, or I could do those changes in tomorrow's version, not the full version, but just.
Yes, that would be helpful. That would be more helpful Then cross the phone.
Yeah.
Follow up in here and handwrite and stuff.
Generally just sort of underline it.
Yes. Yeah, that would be helpful, thank you. And then on that basis we might have some questions for you, but we'll worry about that at that point.
In terms of the 42-hour report, anything that might be useful for you to highlight here is just on page 39, there's a map in the 42-hour report where the outline has moved slightly.
Is that
figure 2? Yes, that's right. Figure 2, the red line should
sit.
It's probably quite clear if you compare it to the other plans. That needs to sit over the sites that are completely unzoned and the adjacent green sites.
Yes, so does it also cover all of the P3?
I can read you that one. Is that useful to review that tomorrow as well?
That could wait for the reply, that one.
Okay. So just as long as you're aware where that
needs
to relate
to. Just a few questions, if I may. A landmark building, there's probably a reference to it somewhere in a minute, but what's that mean? What's a landmark building?
Well, my interpretation of that would be a building that, becomes a landmark in time. It's something that, it's quite obvious. It might be prominently obvious in a good way, slightly higher. Might have a clock tower, as an example that Michelle gave. To me it's prominent, it's something that people associate with, and one of the first things that springs to mind when they think of the Queenstown Town Centre, that building, let's meet under that building, and everyone would know what that building was, and quite often it might have a big dome or something that's prominent about it, and quite obviously a little bit different to some of the other buildings, quite unique.
So a more refined question, is it a term that is somehow defined within the proposed plan, or is it?
No, that's a good point. It's not. I can't off the top of my head think whether it is within the special character area guidelines. I can look up there and get back to you on it. I don't know that it would be. It's not defined in this thing.
Background documents such as iwi management plans. In particular, in relation to the iwi management plans, is there any manner in which they're represented or given a fit to within the...
Well, there is mention in the Queenstown Town Centre in relation to involving Naitahu, in terms of the design of built form and open spaces in the public. So in fact, which mainly has such a strong relationship with even management plan, perhaps the district-wide objectives of the district plan. In short, I don't think there's a strong link between the even management plan and the Burnstown Town Centre zoning provisions. There is that, and there's an acknowledgement of Wahi Tupuna, which is the new term that's probably actually only come into being since the iwi management plan was drafted. So we've acknowledged ways for values in respect of the waterfront subzone as well. So those are the only two sort of provisions in this in the sign that relate to iwi issues.
The cultural consultation type element in terms of design?
Something that's been added. No, there's the Wahita Huna. I've also added policy. Acknowledge and celebrate our cultural heritage, including incorporating reference to tangata, whenua, or values in the design of public spaces through the process.
So the page reference or the page?
12.3.
Oh, sorry,
12.3 of the provisions.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Is there a reference in your 42A report there, or? Well, never mind. Maybe. You can pull it up from the slide.
I've got a couple of general questions first. The first one actually relates to Dr. Charles' evidence. I'm going to ask you now, it doesn't necessarily relate to this. In paragraph 4.5, it says, page 9 of his evidence.
Okay, sorry, yeah.
Yes. So, at the top of page 9, in probably paragraph 4 from 5, it said there may need to be consequential amendments to clarify the exclusion of those sources in notified rules. What I was wondering if you could be able to advise us of where there is actual scope for that.
This is what? Well, I mean, my take on it was that it was non-sustainable and that the rules drafted, it says within the town centre zone only. So we always moved to it from those words to clarifying that that doesn't exclude the sub-zone of the town centre. And that draft then essentially came from Dr. Charles, the initial in his institution. No, I know that's not relevant to how someone might read it on its face, but that was certainly the intention by the words within the town centre only, was that it was never to apply to sub-zones of the town centre. So we've made that change to clarify that. But in addition to that, I mean, people have asked for stricter noise rules,
right.
And this is in part achieving what they want.
So
it strengthens the noise rules in relation to the transition sub zone.
So in terms of what he is recommending there, you've carried that through in your version of the rules, have you?
Yeah.
Right, that's fine. The other broad question just in terms of Dr. Charles' discussion of the entertainment precinct of Queenstown Town Centre. In your view, is there any danger that the long-term effect of that provision would be to concentrate bars and restaurants in the mall to the exclusion of retail activities?
Well, not being a retail specialist or,
I'm just asking you,
how the market was, you know, who's going to be the winner at the end of the day in terms of, you know, high-end use of those different premises. But yes, it could. I mean, it could become a bar, restaurant, cafe strip, and the retail would go. And from a noise perspective, it's beneficial that it's busted. And from a retail and other perspective, it may not be a significant issue.
And it, your view as a planner, if that was to be the outcome of the board?
I don't think that's appropriate.
Okay.
It would be my preference, so I don't know if it's fatal if that's what happens.
Concept,
I can't direct you to any particular district, particular provisions I'm aware of. I mean, we've attempted to do that in this district plan in terms of policy, which suggests strongly that it's an urban design benefit that we look favourably at over height buildings, etc., if you provide urban design benefits such as pedestrian linkages and laneways. So that's how we've attempted, or I've attempted to do it in this chapter. And through both, through that key policy for non-compliant buildings and discretionary buildings as well. Or sorry, discretionary and non-compliant height encroachments.
In your section 42A report on page 6, paragraph 4.3, I'm just trying to get clear in my mind what you're telling us here. That are you saying that there were submissions in relation to the land covered by plan change 50? That because of the withdrawal of that, no longer submissions on the plan, and that you've shown those separately on the table in the expert, that so we can essentially ignore what's in that table. Is that?
Yes, that was my understanding of what the panel had requested previously.
Yes.
So that's how the printed version looks, actually.
Yeah, no, that's fine. On page 14, paragraph 7.4, then you say that more descriptive and directional policies were added and the assessment matters removed. Was that because they were shown to be ineffective?
The assessment matters?
Yes.
I can't really answer that, to be honest. It was a decision, from my understanding, made by the council that in principle, in terms of the formatting of the district plan, it would be possible they would remove assessment matters, and where necessary in lieu of that would be replaced with far more direction within the policies. No, that wasn't as direct result in monitoring and saying that the assessment matters themselves were. And at least as far as this chapter is concerned,
we're not effective or anything. In C, in the same paragraph, you talk about the proposed inner link road, and it's been referred to elsewhere. What is that?
It's the.
Is it shown on the plan?
I'm not going to call it a bypass. It's the secondary road from Mann Street through. So running from Melbourne Street through Henry and around to Mann Street.
And to what extent is that a real proposal?
Well, from my experience, it's a real proposal. I was involved in it quite heavily in the last round of assessment and taking it to the next step in terms of the business case approach for the NZTA. And I understand it's currently being reconsidered now and further worked on. I've had more involvement in that, so I understand it's a real proposition. I think it's a case of when, perhaps, rather than if.
Would that require designation or plan change?
Depends where it runs. It depends where it runs, particularly through from Henry Street through to Mann Street, and what land it runs through there. That's where it would require land acquisition and either designation or resource consent or plan change.
and still on the same paragraph in G, you refer there to the revised design guidelines. I just want to clarify, were they incorporated into the plan by reference?
Yes, they're the design guidelines that we've been discussing with Billy's.
Series of detailed questions on the district plan, but we might wait till after the adjournment to start on those. I'll adjourn until 3:50. Mm-hmm.